Hello, everybody, and welcome to the H2O Talk podcast, the podcast that's all about water and environment. And I'm here with co-host Greg Dewey. We have an exciting show planned for you today. We're going to be talking about water treatment, and we're going to have a guest on board. His name is Mickey Conway, and he is the CEO of Metro Water Recovery here in Denver. They essentially treat the water for about 2 million people, very large regional operation, and also a world-class organization. I was on their board for a number of years, and I just had to have Mickey on at this point. So before we move ahead, and we'll do a little water news, but I also wanted to announce that we are now on Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, and what's the other one?
iHeartRadio,
yes. Thanks, Greg. So Greg, I'll tell you what, why don't we do a little water news, and then we'll talk to Mickey in a little bit. You, I know, came up with something here, so go ahead with that.
We had a very active weather pattern over the weekend here in Colorado, but in the West Coast, they've had a very active atmospheric river conditions. And I saw where the driest place on Earth, Death Valley, was under a flood watch.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, I've never thought I'd hear about that.
But. Yeah, occasionally they get downpours down there, but it's not very often you think of Death Valley and floods. So another example of our changing weather, and California's taken the brunt of this.
They said that if enough rain fell in Death Valley, there could be a temporary lake form.
Probably.
And I know there's been quite a bit of flooding in the area.
Yeah, yeah. And folks I know out in California have been asking how they're doing. So far, I guess they're in pretty good shape, but it's kind of expected during these types of El Nino years. It seems like California has its mudslides and things. So, well, I also have a little story here. This has to do with kind of near where I grew up. And the headline is, this is IFL Science, this North American river is loaded with drugs posing a risk to aquatic animals, which is a problem I think a lot of people are hearing about. This is the St. Lawrence River, which flows on the border of Canada and the United States, flows towards the Great Lakes. It's a big shipping channel. I used to go up there because I grew up about 100 miles south, and we used to go up to the Thousand Islands and stay and swim in the river, etc. But essentially what they're saying is the waters of the St. Lawrence are flowing with antidepressants, stimulants, painkillers, and many other kinds of drugs. So this was a fairly new study that was done. Basically, they say researchers at the University of Montreal collected over 400 water samples along a 700-kilometer or about 430-mile stretch of the river between 2017 and 2021. And these things are kind of building through time. The most recurrent substances were caffeine, anti-inflammatory painkillers, antidepressants, epilepsy treatment medicines, beta blockers to treat hypertension and arrhythmia, and they also found levels of chemotherapy drugs. So this is something that's happening, and it might be something we can bring up to our guest about all these pharmaceuticals in the water and how well we can treat for them. But, you know, that's a big river that's touching the ocean, that's touching the Great Lakes, and just that one area. There's a lot of stuff in that water. Get on your water skis, open your mouth, and take your medicine. Oh, man. So I thought I would bring that up as a little bit of news.
I mean, we've been looking at emerging contaminants or constituents of emerging concern.
Mm-hmm.
That was the buzzword about 15 years ago. And I think, you know, we're still trying to find that. A lot of that is because we were able to detect to finer limits than we used to. So now we're talking parts per trillion instead of parts per million.
And it's like the PFAS, the forever chemicals. We're really down to those very small measurement limits. So, and those are other problems. I'm sure there's a lot of those in the lake. It's a shipping channel, so there's probably a lot of other things. But this was a focus on pharmaceuticals. Anyway, maybe our guest Mickey Conway can speak to that. And today it's just Greg and I. Tom Check is out doing some consulting work right now, so he will not be with us today, but we hope to have him on board fairly soon. Without further ado, I will go ahead and move us over to our guest speaker, Mickey Conway. So hello and welcome, Mickey Conway of Metro Water Recovery, the CEO of that organization. Mickey, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself first, and then we'll get on to the conversation.
I'm Mickey Conway, the CEO of Metro Water Recovery in Denver. We're a clean water resource recovery facility. Takes care of 2.2 million people in the Denver metro area. I came into the water world by way of the legal world. I'm a lawyer and practiced law on the East Coast in New Jersey and New York for about 20 years. A large part of my practice was with water entities, public entities doing drinking water and wastewater, and just fell in love with that world the minute I stepped into it. I just thought it's, you know, one of the most important things for public health. It's one of the most important things for, you know, human society, and yet very few people talk about it. Very few people are, you know, the kind of people who work in this business are humble, and they're public servant, dedicated type folks, but they're really smart, and they have a good sense of humor, and it's just a cool group, really a neat community. So I just got really enamored with it from the time I stepped foot into it years and years ago. I had an opportunity. I was in private practice. Went from a big firm to creating a firm that kind of specialized in government and water law. Was at a place where my partners were looking to retire, and I was originally from Colorado. I had a chance to become the general counsel at Metro. So moved my young family at the time back to Denver, and it's been 10 years I've been here at Metro. First as general counsel, now as CEO. So it's been a great run, and I really love what I do and love being back in Denver.
Well, thanks, Mickey. You know, and I'd like to say, so I was on the board of directors for a couple terms. You know, it's a large, complex organization, but a lot of people ask me, you know, where's one of the best places you've ever worked? And I bring up Metro because it's a world-class organization. You guys are on top of the cutting edge. You have a lot of talent in there. The leadership is good. The board gets along really well, especially with, I think, 38 people on the board. That's hard to get those 38 people to agree on something, and they get stuff done. So my experience in Metro was a great one, and I really respect the organization.
Yeah, well, you were a great board member, Tom. I remember really enjoyed working with you, and I agree. I think that, you know, we're up to 40 board members now, which is you know, as the Metro keeps growing, we add board members. But I think the foundation of why Metro works so well is that it's a great idea. I mean, it's a partnership, a true partnership between public entities who have this need to take care of wastewater treatment and resource recovery. They view it as a partnership. No, they aren't viewing it as one member's bigger than another, and then they get more benefit out of this deal. So the board members, the communities who are, you know, part of the partnership, come into this thing saying, how do we benefit the region? And let's start with that. And then staff sees that, they feel that, they get support for that. And so we are able to prioritize our projects, our investments, based on regional need. And that is just, it's really unusual. I mean, there are a lot of wholesale providers around the country who have different kind of prioritizations based on their contracts and based on their constituencies. This is a true partnership that really is putting the highest needs of the region on top. And that really makes everything work. And so that's a tribute to the people who put this thing together years ago back in the 60s. And it's a tribute to all the communities and the board members and the leadership of all the communities since to keep it going that way. And it's a unique place to be. And I'm just, you know, and from a leadership level on the staff, it really, really helps to have that support.
Yeah. Greg, looked like you had something on your...
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could also tell us a little bit about how maybe more the, when you first came to back to Denver in Metro, you said you grew up in Colorado, and I was curious where you grew up, but then also when you came back and what first struck you about the Metro area?
I grew up in, well, it was called Littleton, now it's Centennial. I think it was unincorporated Arapahoe County back in the day. It was kind of at the southern end of development back in those days. Went to Arapahoe High School. Most of my friends and most of my family stayed here in Colorado, so I came back quite a bit. I lived in California and New York, but I think coming back and living here as opposed to just visiting, I was really, obviously just the growth was just phenomenal from the 80s to now. But also I think just the diversification of industry and the business community. You know, we were really relying on a couple of pretty major businesses or industries back in the 70s and 80s as a community. And that really changed. I mean, a lot of high tech stuff moving in, obviously a lot of medical, a lot of, you know, folks in the white collar world, as opposed to just oil and gas and stuff that were really kind of dominant back then. That was a big change. And then I think just the fact that so many people have moved here from different parts of the country, that you had a real diversity of culture that was, not that Colorado culture was, I still think it's the greatest, even the original Colorado culture. But I think, I know a lot of people get down on Texans and Californians and people moving here, but it really has added a really pretty American kind of feel to Denver. That was one thing I noticed, especially after living in New York, where it's kind of a world place. Everyone from all over the world is there. Kind of felt like Colorado was a place where everyone from the country had come when I came back. So that was a little bit different, but man, having my kids grow up here has been such a great thing. And it's no knock on New York and New Jersey. It's just schools and ease of life and the weather and having, teaching them how to ski. And it's been really great. So really, really feel blessed to be back in my original home.
Well, one thing I did want to talk to you a little bit about was, can you tell us a little bit? You guys have a lot of operations. You have two treatment plants. You have a 52,000 acre farm. How does that all fit together, and how does that fit with wastewater, especially the farm?
Great question. Yeah, those are the chief assets. So that's a good way to lay it out. In addition to the collection system, which spans over a 700 mile square service area, we've got our two big plants, one in Denver, one in Brighton, and then we've got the farm. And the farm was purchased by board direction back in the 90s in segments, but now it's up over, as you know, Tom, 50,000 some acres. The farm is used as a fixed location, fixed distance location to apply biosolids. So we've got that there as a place to apply biosolids. And about 30, maybe 40% in a good year of our biosolids are applied there on the farm. The rest of them are sold to farmers in the Eastern Plains. We have a number of farm customers. We have a waiting list. Folks would love to get on the list, but we have a pretty, the current customers don't want to give up their shot at our biosolids. So we're producing approximately 90 to 100 tons of biosolids every day from our facilities, and that's where they're going. So the farm was a great vision by the board to pick that up and have that as a place for us to apply. We do grow crops out there. It's dry land farming. My mom's a farmer. She told me never to get into that business. It's a tough business. But it's really not, the purpose of the farm isn't to make a profit off the crops. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. It's really to have that place to put biosolids. And interestingly, and this may be a topic we dig into more going forward, that may become even more valuable depending on what happens with biosolids management options, given the PFAS issues that are coming up. EPA is currently looking at biosolids. Right now I'm on a EPA panel that's looking at that. So having that asset, it may become even more valuable if our biosolids management options get limited.
Well, speaking of PFAS and things like pharmaceuticals, those are a concern. And I was reading, we usually do a little water news at the first part of the show, and I was bringing up a recent article about the St. Lawrence River containing, of course, a lot of water bodies do contain antidepressants, hormones, cancer drugs, etc. So I imagine the situation is similar here in Colorado. Can those be treated for, or is there a limit? Or is there new technology coming on board for maybe cutting that down a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a good place to start with that is to kind of zoom back and think about how the wastewater treatment business was envisioned, especially back around the time the Clean Water Act was enacted in the 70s. So, in the late 60s or even the 40s, 50s, 60s, there were various levels of wastewater treatment going on around the country, ranging from zero, treatment and just dumping things into rivers to primary treatment, which was just settling out, solids for the most part. To starting to develop a secondary treatment regime that's using, various techniques on secondary. Once the Clean Water Act was codified, the concept behind building these plants was to manage domestic wastewater and really nutrient demand and really handling what's coming out of a house is really how treatment plants were designed and conceived. And as we all know, that comes from really a long-term development of technology that started, back thousands of years ago to mimic nature and create a treatment train that basically took care of what this, people basically or animals were producing and putting into waste. Man-made chemicals were really not part of the concept back then. And they really aren't effectively treated by our traditional treatment. Now, there are a number of chemicals that, just naturally break down in different environments. Some of those include pharmaceuticals. We tend to see less of that stuff on the effluent than we do in the influent. There are probably things there that those chemicals are interacting with in the system that's not designed to treat them, but it may be breaking them down. But a lot of this stuff is just literally passing through. The technologies, going forward tend to center around filtration or some, some level of exchange. And they're not great for wastewater. Drinking water is a little bit better positioned to deal with some of these things. One, there's less of those types of things in the drinking water sources. So there's lower levels of concentration of those contaminants. And the water source itself also is cleaner with regard to other solids and other constituents. So it's easier to filter drinking water than it is wastewater. Technology in the short term, we think we could employ to really reduce pharmaceutical effects on the effluent. But there's a lot of research going on, in that space. And we're hopeful. And I've seen things change. And, in the 20 plus years I've been in this business, we've made some really great advancements. But like the same thing in the PFAS discussion is with the pharmaceuticals. This stuff does not belong in the water cycle at all. It shouldn't be put in, and it certainly we shouldn't be viewing the wastewater treatment systems, which are publicly funded, to be the backstop for removing this stuff out of the system. It really is not the place to do it. It's the most least efficient place to do it, as opposed to not letting it get into the system in the first place. So education, other technology to make sure that, this stuff, as they develop it, breaks down more easily within systems. I think that's going to be a more effective use of our public dollars than putting in, endless filtration or whatever it is. Those are high energy intensive. They're long-term stream. There's other waste streams that come out of filtration. It doesn't end at the plant. So I think that's kind of where we are right now, but there is a lot of work being done on hopefully breaking down those chemicals.
Yes. Speaking of things that shouldn't be in the waste stream, and you brought up a really good point that it's probably more economical and more effective to get it, to keep it out in the first place. Are there other things you're seeing in the waste stream that you could tell the listeners to keep out of the waste stream?
Well, certainly any physical objects that are going to create difficulty for the collection system and the treatment plant, like, for instance, wipes. Any type of wipe that says it's flushable is likely not. There are some new wipes that are supposedly better than, kind of the previous ones. But putting things other than, your water and the waste into the sinks, the showers, the toilets is not a good idea. It could cause problems for you right there locally in your home, right there in your street. It causes your treatment plant problems. There are, you know, famous pictures out there of stuff that balls up. They call them fatbergs or all other kinds of obstructions that cause, you know, public health issues. They can overflow sewers. People get sick. Animals can get harmed. So that's first, I think. Certainly, flushing pharmaceuticals, flushing any type of chemical, heavy greases, all those things cause problems for us because we are not a place that can deal with that stuff. So, you know, yeah, I think you put food in your sink, that's fine. You know, if your sink can handle it, or you got a compactor, or you know, but other than that, really, nothing should go in your sink or your shower other than your water and what's coming off your body.
I was going to say my father-in-law would be proud to hear this because even though he's got a garbage disposal, he's like, nope, it goes in this paper sack.
Sounds like my mom, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so I told my son. Just don't use your garbage disposal, so you really have to.
Yeah.
And one of the things... looking at the profession of going into wastewater treatment, water treatment in general, for example, this semester I have a student environmental engineer that's very interested in going into wastewater. And we were joking about, you know, the old honeymooners. You had Ralph and Norton. Ralph drove the bus and Norton worked in the sewer plant. And I said, yeah, it's not very sexy to be sitting in a bar. And they say, where do you work? And you say, I work at the sewer plant. But that's not true. It's really a fascinating field to be in. And yeah. people that go into this, from my experience, it's just a water district or probably the wastewater where you are, it's a very stable profession. And, you know, they might go into and try that out and they end up staying. So it's a worthwhile profession. It's something that does help society. Without wastewater treatment plants, what are we going to do? And you probably, how's your turnover? Is it pretty minimal? I think people are pretty happy there.
As an overall statement for the organization, we've got about 500 employees. Our turnover is about 10%. That's a little, our vacancy rate is about 10%. That's a high for us. And I think that's reflective of just a couple of turbulent years here after COVID. It's starting to come down again. In the operator group, our turnover is very low. And I love, Tom, I love the fact you bring up the honeymooners because I bring that up all the time. When I talk to folks about careers, I say, you know, this old idea that it's Jackie Gleason getting dirty in the sewer. I mean, these guys is not true. These guys are using incredibly complex technology. It's super cool stuff. They are managing a system which is, you know, in this effect, the largest chemistry experiment in the metro area. That's what we are. And it is really interesting stuff. And you go home and you put your head in the pillow and you protected your community every night. We also pay pretty well for this job, and there's career advancement opportunities. And one of the things I tell a lot of kids that I meet with is there is an opportunity right now for you as young people that is rare, because there's a huge band of folks that are about 55 to 70 who are all thinking about retirement, and they're in the management, you know, ranks. And they're all going to retire. And all of you young people are going to have a very, very good chance to move up, populate great jobs, interesting work, fulfilling work in short order. I mean, faster than we were able to do it, you know, in our generation. So, you know, a lot of these young kids say that we screwed up the world, and they may be right in some respects. But we're leaving some opportunity for them right now. If you get in some of these careers, it's ahead of you. And they're really neat careers. And I agree. I think being a wastewater operator, once you understand what it's about, it's a super interesting job. And our folks who do it are really proud of it. And the level of people we get applying for these jobs is really impressive. So we're really blessed. We have the best in the business doing this here.
Well, I really appreciate it, too. And I want to say kudos to you and your staff. Thank you for keeping us safe. I can guarantee that out of all utilities, and I believe all utilities are important, that if I lost wastewater, that would be the first one I would be worried about.
Yeah. 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 I know nobody really talks about that, but you're right. I mean, without that, you want to get the phones ringing. I would do it.
Well, another thing that Metro is well known for is its innovation. You guys are looking, you're visionary, you look to the future, you look at cutting edge technology. When I was on the board, they built the North Treatment Plant, and that's a very sophisticated, cutting edge plant. The old plant you have, the Robert Height, I know you were kind of building, enhancing the secondary treatment, and you might be going to tertiary treatment, which kind of polishes the water. What other kind of innovation type things are you doing? And I'm kind of thinking of the Denver Stock Show complex and power generation, that type of thing. And there's probably
I think that we are one of the most innovative wastewater utilities in the world. And I've got a lot of facts to back that up. One thing we've done structurally is we elevated a position called the Chief Innovation Officer to the C-suite. We recently hired Tanya Rock Williams, who's a nationally recognized, internationally recognized practice leader in wastewater from the consulting community. She decided to come work for us. She is helping to guide a program that, to your point, Tom, has been successful for years, but we're really moving to, I think, a new plane with this. Because what I've seen is all of the challenges we have coming at us from the regulatory side, from the asset side, are all solvable with smart people and smart ideas. And so getting the right people there is 95% of the battle. And then giving them the resources and the freedom to fail. And that's what part of what innovation is. You do have to try some things that don't work, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you're going to pull the plug on the whole program. So we've done that. And some of the successes we've had are in the multi/hundreds of millions of dollars of savings, you know, realm, which our ratepayers want to hear. But there are also ideas that are being copied and used all over the country and all over the world. So one of them you just mentioned is we've got an issue with heat. Our effluent needs to be cooled. CDPHE wants to see cooler effluent going into the Platte River for improvement of aquatic life. The traditional way of doing that is to set up cooling towers. Those are a bad idea for wastewater. They are incredibly energy intensive, greenhouse gas producing, very difficult. We're not even sure it would actually work. We're piloting technologies right now. So we're thinking about what are ways to do this in, you know, in an innovative way that meets sustainability goals and that also connects our community. And one way is to extract the heat from the system itself. Vancouver has a fairly large system that we looked at a couple of years ago. So we've partnered with National Western. They're taking heat out of one of our largest interceptors, running a district heat loop system there. It'll heat and cool the, they have the ability now with the build out to do the entire, footprint of the National Western. That is, it's heat that never stops coming. As we all know, wastewater is hot because people take hot showers, they run the dishwasher. That's lost. It's just a lost opportunity if you don't take it. So we're working with a number of folks around the Denver area to talk about expanding that program, trying to take out as much heat before it gets to us as possible to minimize any work we have to do here at the site. So that's, you know, sustainable, classically sustainable heat. And working with a partner in Denver that's gone really well, and it's coming online fully now, and so it's really exciting. Other innovations we're working on, like on the plant site, there's something called MagPrex, which precipitates phosphorus, in stream, creates a fertilizer product. So it's limiting, you know, it's helping us reach very low phosphorus limits, which all of us in the Front Range are faced with. And creating a product that is beneficial for farming and frankly saving us a lot of money because phosphorus management is very expensive too. So, a lot of times we look at money as an afterthought, or at least the regulatory side looks at money as an afterthought. But, you know, the folks who pay our bills are having a hard time paying their car bill and their food bill, especially folks in some of the disadvantaged areas. We've got to look at solutions that also are lessening cost impact. So those are a couple of just recent innovations that we've employed that are not being done nationally. Like MagPrex, we're the only ones do it in the country. The heat is, our heat exchanger is the biggest one in the country. And we're trying to lead there. Other people are coming here, looking at our stuff and talking to us. And then we're doing a lot of work on densification. We're doing work on, ultimately what we might be able to do with biosolids if we're not going to be able to land apply. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on, but it does take commitment. It does take some short-term investment that sometimes you don't see an immediate payback on, but we believe in it. And so far, it's paid off.
Yeah, and I think that's why you guys have gotten so many awards nationally, internationally, for the work that you're doing, which is really impressive.
Yeah, our board has supported this. And, you know, in the East Coast, I represented utilities that were very cash-strapped, smaller utilities, some of them, that just didn't have the bandwidth to invest in something like this. So they relied on consultants, which was good. They, you know, smart folks helping us all the time. But to have an internal team be able to prioritize and do this work, you know, it's really fortunate. It's really a good situation to be in.
Well, on the fun side, and I think this might still go on, but one thing I didn't know about was, and I don't know what the name of it is, but it's competition. It's like kind of the wastewater Olympics that you guys have had.
Are you talking about Ops Challenge?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people into it. Can you explain that a little bit? That's something most people probably never heard of.
Yeah. So there may be companion kind of teams like this in the drinking water side. But in the clean water side, we have something called Ops Challenge, where wastewater plants will pick a team of different disciplines, and they go through some different events in a competition setting. And so they do them, they're timed, and then some of the events are scored, like they have a lab event. They do a safety event where they're assembling, disassembling pumps. They do all this as fast as they can, and they have to do it, you know, there's a judging part of this also. They have to do everything precisely. And the teams are pulled together, and they compete regionally, and then they compete nationally if you win your regionals. And the Metro team, our number one team, won the national championship two years ago and 3 years ago. This year we lost, and I don't want to say anything about the refs, but, you know, we should be winning. But we have a nationally one of the best teams in the country. Our B team, and it's, I use that as kind of, shouldn't be pejorative, they won their division, or they were close to the top of their division last year, so they'll be in the top division again. So we'll have two teams in the top division. We have a lot of pride about doing this. And the best thing about it is that it brings folks from different parts of the organization together. We have engineers and operators and maintenance folks and some people from the administrative staff, and they get together on a team. They might not naturally mingle or interact, and they fight like hell to win that trophy. And there's a lot of pride for the team. There's a lot of pride for the organization. And then when you get to the event, they run it at WEFTEC which is either Chicago or New Orleans over the last couple of years. And there's a whole room full of all these wastewater teams. And it is seriously one of the coolest things you'll ever see. Everyone supports each other. They're all cheering for each other. And it's just, you know, it's a great way to, like you said, have some fun. But these guys are, the skills that they're working on are things that they use as part of, you know, managing the critical things that we have to do here. So it's really relatable. And it's just, yeah, it's really a point of pride for a lot of us.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know who came up with it, but that's a great team building type of thing. I mean, in real, and I've seen them practice on the property there, and it was really cool.
Yeah, if you ever get to WEFTEC and you get to watch the competition, I mean, it's cool. It's intense. People are watching and screaming and yelling, and you know, the judges are there with their stopwatches and their, you know, their pads, and they're writing everything down. It's pretty, there's a little bit of you know, tension there.
And you mentioned something interesting, that it involves members from all parts of the organization. So I think that's a testament of the culture at your organization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that was really my kind of job one when I became CEO. I tend to be, you know, in the CEO world of strategy versus culture, I'm probably lean more towards culture. I like team building, and I like collaboration. I'm really a fan of those tools. And we have stressed a collaborative environment. It's one of our four core values. And bringing people into the room when we talk about problems, listening to somebody who may not be directly managing the project or directly, you know, the stakeholder you might not think of, but still is going to be affected. And we've really gotten to a place where that's become kind of a standard for everybody as we talk through all of the issues we have to talk through. And I'm proud of that, but I'm especially proud of the team, the executive team that I put together, because they champion that all throughout the organization. They're really good at it. And I think what you get out of that, it's an inclusive kind of feeling that people feel they have a stake and they feel they have, you know, some piece of the direction of the organization. And that goes all the way down to people who are implementing, you know, implementing changes at the line level. And they're able to do that. They're able to be heard, and they're able to be able to, you know, get involved in a discussion about how they can make something better. So that's probably the thing I'm most proud of, is that we built that, and that the folks that I've been fortunate enough to help put into place do even a much better job than I do with championing that and pushing that, because I just see that as absolutely indispensable when you have the type of business that you have, which is a new kind of problem every day. If we just did the same thing, it seems like wastewater would be the same thing every day, but it just really never turns out that way. So having that, you know, inclusive culture where you're saying, hey, is this hitting everybody the same way? And somebody's saying, no, this is different. We're seeing this differently than you do. And then being okay with listening to that, being people feeling like they can contribute that, that's been a huge thing for us. I'm really, really happy that people have embraced it.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah. So, Mickey, we're kind of coming up on our time, but I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the future of wastewater treatment. Where are we going? I mean, there's more people, there's more chemicals. What are some of the real challenges that are facing you that you have to really think about at this time of your operation?
I think we're going to be in a good space on the technology and in the innovation place. I think we're going to continue to adapt our thinking and find solutions to problems. I think the big challenge is going to be in our relationship with our customers, our relationship with the public that we serve, and ensuring that they understand first and foremost what the value of what we're giving them is, because it's going to become more expensive. What we're doing is going to take up a bigger portion of their paycheck than it did before. It's getting really expensive. And one of the reasons it's getting really expensive is because the public is demanding cleaner water. They're demanding cleaner air. Those things don't happen with a turn of a dial. As we know, to get down to lower and lower limits of contaminants is an exponentially larger investment in energy and chemical and expense. So really talking to our communities and listening to our communities about what their priorities are. Just saying we'll have perfectly clean water is not okay. What we have to say is, what do you want and what are you willing to pay for? And what else could we use this money for, right? So I have this talk that I give called One Environment, and it comes out of the concept of One Water, which we all think is a good idea, that the drinking water and the stormwater folks and the wastewater folks all should be talking to each other, not be at cross purposes. But really, we have to think bigger than that. And in the water world, things have, you know, effects in the air world. Cleaning water causes air pollution. Are we okay with that? Well, let's talk about it. If we are, then we are. But we're not having that next level conversation about prioritizing net environmental benefit. The other thing that's really important is that, you know, one of the, and we talked about this previously, but one of the big issues we're going to be facing is, can we afford what we want? And we see this, I think, we saw this a lot when we talked about healthcare. You know, we have the ability to treat everybody, but we don't have the money to treat everybody. This is going to become an issue with water. We have the ability to make water cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and find and detect, you know, nanoparticles of things that we could never detect before and start to spin off technology to deal with that. Can we afford to do that? And because if we can and we want to spend that money, we're ready to do it. We can do that. But we're also public servants, and our goal is to promote public health and the environment and protecting the environment. There may be better uses for some of these expenditures. And I think it's important to talk about that. And a very quick example, and I hope I'm not going over my time, but
no, we're good.
Is lead. And lead is a great example. So Denver Water gets a lead hit back in 2010, 11, whenever it was. CPHE comes in and says, you know, we want you to put phosphorus, use phosphorus as your control technique, technology. We step in and say, this is a bad idea. You're going to be sending us, you know, tons and tons of phosphorus every year that we now have to invest hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to continually remove. It's a bad cycle. It's not good for anyone. What we ended up doing was, you know, getting into a bigger conversation about going to the source of the problem, taking the lead lines out. Metro contributed $20 million to Denver Water's lead pipe removal program. That's not wastewater treatment. That's not resource recovery. That's cost avoidance for Metro customers who are basically, you know, very similar customers to the Denver Water customers. But it's a better place for that money to go than to build phosphorus treatment to take out phosphorus that's continually added into the stream. Metro has billions of dollars in our next 10 years on our capital expenditure schedule for things like PFAS and other contaminants, try to get ahead of those, build a tertiary system, where if we could invest $50 million in keeping PFAS out of the system altogether, then the rest of that money can go to better public health benefits.
Sure.
So I think one of the things we risk is some people thinking that we just want to avoid doing the work or avoid making the investments. And it's not that. I just want to see the money go to the right place and have the best environmental and public health bang for your buck. We will invest billions of dollars in clean water and continue to do it. But we don't want to make investments that aren't the best benefit for our communities. So back to your original question, hearing our communities and what their priorities are and really understanding that and being able to deliver on those priorities, I think that's the biggest challenge for our sector in the next 10 years.
So I like that way of thinking. I didn't know you contributed to the lead pipe removal, which is great. So, you know, you're going beyond just what your usual mission is, but you're looking at the big picture too.
Yeah.
And as you're gaining that input from the communities, is that through the board or are there other places for people to submit their comments?
Great question. So that's a program that we are literally standing up right now, a community engagement program. Our new strategic plan added a third pillar, which is, you know, we've had our work and our kind of what we do, or the people that we do it. Now we have our community as our third pillar. We traditionally have done education. We've done tours. We've, you know, had interactions at that kind of level. We are building out a full community engagement program. We're going to start kind of tactically in the neighborhoods right around the Hype plant and around our Brighton plant, get to know our neighbors, talk to the leadership of those groups, find out what's important to them and add that to our board input and our educational input and then grow that program from there. So it's really an intentional listening tour right now is kind of what's going on.
Great. Well, I'm convinced that just hearing you talk and just hearing the enthusiasm and the passion you have for this industry and this community, that people's voices will be heard and that you're going to do a great job with the engagement. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that the folks who work in this business are all kind of like that, right? We all really care about this. And, you know, God, if you get cornered by somebody like me at a barbecue, I feel sorry for you because we all like to talk about it. But
yeah, the
but it's important stuff. So, yeah.
It is.
Well, the board, the employees that I've met, everybody there seems to be on a mission and on the same page a lot, which is nice. I mean, it's not like I hate my job. It's like they feel like they're doing something. And I think that just adds that level of pride, which is a great thing.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
it's a cool business to be in.
Yeah, if I were starting over, I would definitely reconsider and go wastewater.
Well, you know, we got plenty of openings here.
Now, you ran, Greg, you ran the water treatment plant up in Loveland for a
short time. I also worked at the wastewater plants. And it's the waste, you're right, wastewater is challenging. Water treatment is, you can kind of set it and forget it for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, the wastewater is more biological. You know, you think about when you eat something that doesn't agree with you.
Right.
Imagine that on a big scale. That's a wastewater plant.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right, exactly.
I was just thinking, too, that Tom Cech's going to be disappointed he missed this.
I think he will be.
Mr. One Water?
Yeah.
He just got one up by one environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. He ran the One World, One Water Center at Metro State University.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're pretty much at our time. So, Mickey, I'd really like to thank you for coming in. And maybe someday down the road we can have you or someone from the water treatment, from the Metro Water Recovery Group come in for other topics involved. But like I said, it's you run a great organization. I'm proud that I was a part of it, and I kind of miss it at times. But it's doing a mission that people tend to forget about. You forget about this infrastructure. You forget about if you shut these things down or you lose power or whatever, who's going to treat your wastewater? And that's a big deal. It eventually will become one. So you really have an important part of maintaining our own health and environment for both us and all the critters out there. So thanks for that.
Well, thanks for having me. And it's important, I think, for people like you guys who are amplifying these messages and this important stuff. I mean, there aren't enough people out there that are talking about this stuff, so I appreciate what you guys do.
Okay. Well, thanks. It's fun. We still, I think some water guys always, it's hard to get them away from the water, so here we are still doing it.
No doubt. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Mickey. And we will talk to you soon. Say hello to everybody for me.
I will. Absolutely.
Bye now.
Great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. The end of another episode of H2O Talk. And I think this was a great one. I learned a lot. Wastewater does have a bit of a learning curve to it. I think if you're in it for the long haul as a career. So I'd just like to thank our listeners for joining in. And remember, you can reach us at H2O Talk Podcast at AOL.com if you want to send comments, questions, or suggest a topic to us. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you have a variety of platforms you can get this podcast on. So you can go to Podbean, you can go to Spotify, you can go to Amazon Music, and you can go to iHeartRadio. And thanks for joining us. We will see you in about 2 weeks. Bye now.